I'm really thrilled to have this session in particular on dealing with permissions and copyright because it was actually suggested by one of your fellow member writers last spring who was writing her first book and was struggling with this issue of how do I find this? Her publisher said, you need the permissions for this. And she said, but I don't know how to do that. Where do I find that? So I think with the number of people in the room today, I think it's obviously a question for a lot of people, whether you're looking for permissions to use in your own work or you're looking to protect your own work. I think it's obviously a big issue. So I'm thrilled to have our two speakers today. I can't thank them enough for coming. On my left right here is Anita Fohr. She's the Director of Legal Services at the Authors Guild, which is the oldest and largest society of writers in the country. And for those of you that don't know, it's a nonprofit membership organization, and it provides free legal advice to its members and advocates on behalf of its members for free expression and fair compensation and, of course, copyright protection. And over on my far left is Debbie Rubina, who is an assistant professor at the Pratt Institute School of Information and Library Science. Her areas of specialization include reference resources, information-seeking behavior, international and comparative librarianship, and information law and policy, which is why she's here today. She's also one of the teachers responsible for turning me into a librarian, so for that I thank her very much. So we're going to start now, and I guess we're going to start with Debbie first, and we're going to have a little sort of mini lecture first, and then we'll, and I know you have lots of questions, so we'll definitely allow time for questions at the end. So again, I thank everybody for coming.
Yes. Could we ask if the speakers would be kind enough to stand, because many of us back here can't see them at all.
I stand all the time. This is how I teach. I'm not used to sitting. I'm actually glad you gave me the opportunity to stand. I'm much more comfortable. Okay. So as Carolyn said, my name is Debbie Rubina. I'm a professor at Pratt Institute. I am not, so this is my disclaimer. I am not an attorney. I'm not a JD. I'm a teacher, so nothing here is legal advice. I guess that will come later from Anita. Carolyn asked me to open with a brief interview, a brief review of what copyright is and what are the main things that you should be aware of. These are certainly interesting times in the world of copyright, and a lot of this has come from the basic war between technology and law. And what are the best ways in which you impose or restrict or limit the use of copyrighted work, and who is going to win this battle? Is it going to be thanks to legal restrictions that come in the form of libraries cannot reproduce copies, they are not allowed to circumvent protections, or will it be technology that always wins because it always finds a way around the restrictions that are given? And the world is getting more complicated for everybody, for librarians and for authors, with a lot of things like self-publishing, online publishing, self-archiving, and different alternatives to copyright, to traditional copyright. So first of all, what is copyright? The definition is that copyright applies to original works of art that are fixed in any tangible form of medium of expression, now known or later to be developed, from which they can be perceived, reproduced, or otherwise communicated either directly or with the aid of a machine and device. So there are several conditions here. First, it has to be an original work. What does original mean? As of 1903, as a result of a Supreme Court case, the threshold for originality has been pretty low. So think of it as kind of like the opposite of patent, where the threshold for originality is very high, and whatever you're patenting has to be something that has not existed before. With something that is eligible for copyright, some changes and modifications to an existing work can be considered original and therefore eligible for copyright. The other condition is that it has to be fixed in some sort of tangible form. So what I'm saying to you now is not fixed. It's words, they're just out there, but they're actually being recorded. So once they're being recorded, they're fixed. So this is copyrightable, and I haven't actually signed my permission for that, but I'm sure that will come in the end. There it is. But words are not. So what we are copywriting is not the idea, but the expression of the idea. So if Thomas Friedman is saying that the world is flat, that's an idea, you can go with it. You know, you can write a poem that the world is flat, and you can further develop the thesis that the world is flat, and you could do whatever you want. The idea is not copyrightable. But the way he fixed that idea in the newspaper article or in a book or in a lecture, that is now copyrightable. And it has to be fixed in some sort of medium that can be perceived or later developed. And again, this is in anticipation for technologies that we do not know what they are. So it can be fixed in paper and in sculpture, but also in any kind of digital device as well. So just in terms of what gets protection for copyright, and the list is rather long. Books get protection. Maps, navigational charts, they also get protection, although they don't, you wouldn't think that they are original works. If you're making a map, you usually want it to be true to life. This, it has historical reasons. It was done to encourage exploration, although a lot of the maps that, you know, like the Clark were all, they all belonged to the government anyway, because it was government-funded expeditions. It is considered that the selection, arrangement, and presentations of maps are creative. Prints, even though prints are a mechanical reproduction of something, there is a level of skill in the crafting of creating a print, so that is that gets copyright. Paintings, drawings, sculptures, music, photographs, drama, movies, computer programs, records, tapes, dance, as in the notations of the dance, architecture, all of those get protection. Characters, as in literary characters, you know, like Superman or whoever, they also get copyright protection, but that's only been recognized by courts. It's not part of the copyright law. But you cannot take Superman and, you know, reproduce him in your work. So what kind of rights do the copyright holders have? First of all, they have the very basic right to control the copies of whatever it is that they're doing. So they have the right to reproduce their own work. They have the right to distribute it. And again, all of this is subject to some restrictions. So the right to distribute is subject to the first sale doctrine. So if you buy a book, you now have the right to give it to somebody else. That is actually how libraries operate. Once they buy the work, they can circulate it. The right to create derivative works is also held by the copyright owner. So if somebody wants to do a play on it, or an abridged, or a translation, or an annotated version of whatever work you published, you have the rights for that. The rights over public performance of a work is also with the copyright holder. The right for public display, and this is usually for work of arts. And again, this is also subject to the first sale doctrine. So if you bought a piece of work and you wanted to display it in your lobby, you can do that. And the right to attribution and integrity is in the US only recognized for visual arts, meaning if you have created a sculpture and somebody bought it, they have to continuously attribute it to the creator, and they're not allowed to disform it in any way. They have to keep it intact as it was intended to be. So all of these are the basic rights that the copyright holder has. Now, what are some of the limits for that? The most known one is fair use. Fair use allows you to do some uses without having to have permission from the copyright holder. Fair use is probably the most known in educational and in library settings, but it can be used for individual settings as well. The problem with fair use is that it's always a question of balance. So there are four conditions to what constitutes fair use, and there isn't a very strict formula of these four. It's kind of like a judgment call, and if you're not sure, it's better to consult with somebody. And again, the handout that we have has a whole list of resources that can help you get a more of an idea for what fair use is. But some of the four conditions to what would constitute fair use, first of all, is the purpose. The purpose of what you are going to be using the work for. So if you're using somebody's words or you want to quote somebody, and it will be, you will be using it commercially, you will be selling that, that's usually considered less fair than if you're writing a scholarly article about something. So non-commercial use is considered more fair than commercial use, although there are, of course, exceptions to this. So for example, movie reviews or literary reviews, even though they're commercial, they're usually considered fair use. The second measure for fair use is the nature of the copyrighted work. Are you citing something that is factual or fiction? If you're citing another scholarly paper, usually more fair than if you're citing a poem. The amount of the work that you are using. So if you are citing one page out of 400, that is usually considered more fair use than if you are citing 200 out of 400 pages. Again, all of these have exceptions. It kind of like depends on what those 400 words would be. And there have been cases where 400 words were considered out of an entire book were considered not fair use. I don't know how much stories you want to hear, but the most well-known case about this was Gerald Ford's memoir that was published, that was reviewed for The Nation, and they cited 400 words, 250 words?
300
words. But they were like the only 300 interesting words in the whole book. It was basically about why he pardoned Nixon. So the publisher rightly felt that the market effect was killed. You know, once people read the report of The Nation, they had no reason to buy the book. There was nothing else in the book that was of much interest. So, you know, it can go in many ways. And the last...
Did the publisher win in that case?
I'm sorry?
Did the publisher win?
Yes. And it was Harper, I believe. And the last measure is effect in terms of effect on the market. So what effect on the ability to sell the original work will you using it have? There are cases where it could kill the market, like with Ford, but sometimes it would actually encourage people to go look for the original book if you're citing it. So that too can go in many ways. Usually, if your parody is usually considered fair use, again, reviews are usually considered fair use, criticism is usually considered fair use. There are things that are in the public domain. Anything that is printed or produced or created by the US government is in the public domain. So, you know, you can take the Monica Lewinsky report and you can reprint 500 copies of it and you could sell it for profit on the corner of 79th Street. Not a problem. It belongs to you. You paid for it with your tax dollars. Things that were published generally prior to 1923 are considered in the public domain. In the handout that I have for you in the end, there is a list of resources that could help you determine a lot of these things. One of them is a copyright slider, which is a very nice interactive tool where you can look up specific dates and conditions of publication and see what copyright licenses or restrictions apply to that work. So the concerns for authors are usually things like, what do I need permission for if I am writing a work? What should I be looking for? When is it okay for me to just cite something? And when do I have to find the person who owns the copyright, track them down, and get explicit permission from them to use this work? And then this is kind of like a lot of this is, it depends. It depends who you're asking. If you are writing a work and you are under contract with a publisher, they will always tell you to seek permission for everything. There's just like, you know, and they will have permission forms for you. And again, we have some examples that Carolyn will give out later. If you are involved in something like a self-publishing press, like, I don't know if you're familiar with Lulu, or there's another one, I forgot the name of that.
Universe or Author House?
I guess there's dozens of those. I don't keep track. But they actually leave it to the discretion of the author to decide what. They have their regular disclaimer, and again, we have a copy of that as an example. But they leave it to the authors to decide what. They have advice, but, you know, no mandates in that respect. A lot of it is your judgment, and a lot of it is just, you know, your kind of like view of the world. Are you very cautious, or are you kind of like willing to test the limits of what copyright is? When you are going to seek out a license, there are several types of licenses or permissions that you may several things, types that you should be aware of. We have exclusive or non-exclusive rights. If somebody gives you exclusive rights, basically mean giving up copyright. So if somebody, you know, if you're asked to sign an exclusive rights, that means that you're giving your copyright of what you wrote to the publisher. And the same if somebody's giving you exclusive rights to use their work, you can do anything you want with it. That is usually not the case. We also have limited or absolute rights. Limited could be limited to a specific period of time. So you are allowed to make use of this work for the next 5 years. Or limited can also be limited in terms of a geography. It can be only done in the US, but you don't have the rights to publish it or distribute it in other countries. It can be, permissions and licenses do not have to be written. They can also be verbal. It's probably not to your advantage if you're going to this length of trouble to have a verbal agreement. It is much better to have a written one, but they can be verbal. There can also be expressed licenses and permissions, but also implied. So when you are, for example, sending a letter to the editor, it is implied that you are giving them to write to publish it. So anything that is in that public arena in that way usually has implied copyright. When you are getting any type of license or permission to use somebody else's work, there are some things that should be included in the body. These are really sort of like the minimum, and they can get quite lengthy, but I'm again of the school of the simpler the better. So you want to have just like general information, who the parties are, you know, what is the work that the license is being applied to, what is the date, and all that. You want to state what rights are granted. Are these exclusive rights? Are these non-exclusive rights? Are they limited in some way? You want to also specify the extent of the durations. You want to mention if there are any fees or royalties involved in these rights. Are you expected to pay the owner for the rights or not, or will you expect it to pay them royalties later on? And you may want to have something that addresses termination. Are you or are they, any of the parties involved, allowed to terminate the rights? When you are going out, you have, again, several questions that you need to ask. Where do I find this person? And there's no one place to go, but there are several places to go. Anything that was copyrighted in the United States until the late 80s had to be registered with the U.S. Copyright Office. So today, copyright is given for anything the minute it is written. So like these notes are copyrighted, even though I did not register them with the Copyright Office. This is, again, this is a result of an international treaty that the U.S. signed. But until 1989, only things that were registered. So if you want to cite from a work that's prior to that time, go to the Copyright Office, and again, in the handout, I gave you the link to where they have their database of authors, and it will give you the name of the person. This is not necessarily the last stop, but it's a good start.
I'm sorry, can I just, on that point, can you just elaborate a little bit on how and why that changed?
That changed because the U.S. signed an international treaty, and one of for copyright, the World Intellectual with the World Intellectual Property Organization, and it had to align itself to the provisions of the treaty, and that was one of the conditions. That is actually how we got also the what is in the world known as moral rights, the rights for integrity and attribution for visual works. That was also part of that international treaty. And we got some other things, but that was
a change. That treaty is a good reference for copyright in the U.S. and elsewhere after that date.
After that date, yeah.
And it's the World Intellectual Property Organization?
Yes.
The treaty is actually called the Berne Convention treaty.
Okay.
And that was enacted in March of 1989.
Basically
what the requirement was, we used to in the United States have a requirement that in order to have copyright protection, you had to either publish, in most cases, especially for literary works, you had to actually publish that work. And if you didn't publish, and then you had to register within a reasonable period of time.
Yeah.
So if you didn't publish, you'd register, and for certain other works, you just had to register, then you wouldn't have copyright protection. But given that the other countries, like many European countries, for example, didn't have that, they call it a formality, it's a formal requirement of registration.
Mm-hmm.
In order for us to get in line with their laws, that was something that needed to be enacted.
Mm-hmm.
So curiously, the U.S. had more formalities than the Europeans.
Right. I mean, there's a long history to this. It was one of the things that our legal deposit law was based on, and that has also changed. So it was a requirement to register something, send a copy to the Library of Congress for legal deposit. That's how the Library of Congress built their collection and their book registry, their catalog.
So what you're saying is that the copyright is a moral right rather than just a technical.
Moral right means something very specific, so I wouldn't call it a moral right. But now copyright is by default.
Okay.
That's, I guess, would be. So, like, you don't have to take this tape and register it. It is copyrighted. Okay?
But in order to sue someone for infringing your copyright,
right,
you still do have to register with the United States copyright.
Yeah. It is additional protection, but it's not a requirement.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to sue somebody, then you have
your work has to be registered. In order to get into federal court,
mm-hmm.
in order to sue for copyright infringement, you have to have registered your work with the United States Copyright Office.
Mm-hmm.
Can you register it after the lawsuit or during the lawsuit?
Yeah, you definitely can. So as a prerequisite, you can register and you can go down to the courthouse and file your complaint. I don't want to eat up Dennis' time, but there are the reasons why you want to file in a timely fashion. If I have not filed within the time period that the copyright statute says that I should file in, I can only sue for one type of damages. So I can only sue for like the real world damages that I've incurred if you actually infringe my copyright. But for example, if I sue within 3 months of register within 3 months of first publishing my work, I can sue not only for actual damages, like the amount that you actually cost me by doing what you did, I can also, if it's better for me, because maybe I can't prove that they're actual damages, but I still don't like what you did, right? So I can then argue that I'm entitled to statutory damages, and those can be, anywhere from like $750 all the way up to $30,000. If it's willful infringement, up to $150,000. Maybe that doesn't sound so great to some people necessarily, but the other benefit of it is that I can get my court costs and attorney's fees from you.
But there are lots of things, for instance, letters,
mm-hmm.
that don't come under that at all.
We can talk about that.
Yeah, okay. I'll continue perhaps, and then we can address correspondence and all that. Okay. So you have, you're probably the most comprehensive source is the U.S. Copyright Database. In addition to that, you have several other databases that provide authorship information. One of them is called WatchFile. It's from the University of Texas in Austin. Again, listed on your resource list. Another one still in beta, still being created, but OCLC, which has our which creates WorldCat, which is a very probably the largest catalog, is now adding copyright status to the works in their catalog. And when that is complete, that will be a wonderful source as well. There are also several organizations that will do it for you. And the most known is called the Copyright Clearance Center, which is again listed on your handout, in which you can check specific works and ask them to deal with permissions. This is something that people use a lot, particularly in educational settings. If you remember course packets, which seem to no longer exist, they usually handle permissions for those things as well. What happens when you can't find? You've exhausted all your resources. You've of course tried the publisher. What do you do then? These works that you can't find the owner for, they're what we call orphan works. Orphaned in the sense that you cannot locate their parents. There was the U.S. Copyright Office and the Library of Congress had a committee that made recommendations for orphaned works. And it's basically, and they have several recommendations. First of all, you have to be able to prove and document that you did what they called a good faith search, that you tried everywhere, that you've contacted the publishers, that you looked up in directories. If you know that the author is from Albany, you looked at the Albany phone book and you tried to do whatever it is that you did and you weren't able to find. The other thing that the Copyright Office recommends is that if you tried, you couldn't find the person, you still used their work, 5 years go by, the author surfaces or their heirs or somebody comes and they want to get rights for whatever it is that you use, they will only be entitled to what the copyright calls reasonable compensation, so that it is manageable in some way. And within this same recommendation, non-commercial uses or non-commercial entities like libraries, museums, archives, are usually able to avoid any fees altogether. The last thing I want to mention is alternatives to copyright, because we are seeing a growing area where people choose, rather than copyright their own works, is to use alternatives to that. And the most well-known of those is called Creative Commons. Creative Commons, which you might have seen, it has the two C's, as opposed to the single C in a circle, it has the two C's in a circle. The Creative Commons license means that you are taking your work out of the regular copyright protection and you are making more generous uses to the general public available for your work. And there are four types of uses, and you can use any combination of these that you can apply to your work. The first one is the right for attribution. So you're saying, anybody can use my work, they just have to attribute it to me. You know, they can cite it, they can reproduce it, they can do whatever they want, they just have to put my name on this as the original creator. The other is what is called share alike, meaning whatever conditions I put, the other person has to put as well. So I made my work available to the public for no fee, and you took it and you incorporated it in your work. Your work now has to be shared with the general public under the same conditions, with like no fees or royalties attached. Same conditions trickle down. The other one is non-commercial. The other condition could be non-commercial. So you're saying you can use my work in whichever way you want as long as you're not selling your work. So if you're making it available to the public good, giving it away, contributing it, you can use it. And the last one is non-derivative. So you can use my work as it is, but you can't make it into a play or into an abridged or translated version of it. So you can use it as is. And people can use any combination of these as they want. Attribution, attribution share alike, attribution no derivatives, attribution non-commercial, attribution non-commercial share alike, or attribution non-commercial no derivatives are all the options.
But they don't have to give credit on number 3, 4, or 5?
Attribution is like almost always there. Attribution, and they symbol it by the BY, so it's by. So it would be CC for Creative Commons, and then it'll have a BY, by, so you know that you have the mandate to attribute it to the original creator. So that was my little overview. not too bad.
That's really good.
Okay.
A lot of information in there. Thank you. Then I just, for anybody who came in late, my name is Anita Ford, and I'm the Director of Legal Services with the Authors Guild. I've been with the Guild for about 10 years, and our membership is pretty diverse. It's novelists, and it's historians, and it's memoirists, but we also have journalists, and so when I'm working with authors and trying to help them out with their permissions concerns, I'm usually advising people from both ways. There are people who, you know, they have work that they own the copyright in, and they want to make sure that, you know, for the people who want to make use of it, that they're being asked properly for that. But then I'm also, you know, working with the researchers, the historians, who want to get permissions from, you know, authors to make use of their copyright protected work. And so then I was just interested in the room. Has anyone ever tried to source permissions? Yeah. Yeah. Did you find, what was your experience with it?
I work in publishing. I work in publishing, so for like 30 years I've had anything from easy stuff to things that were too expensive that you couldn't use to the problem that you mentioned where you can't find the source. So I've had a range of experiences.
So you just had the whole range of experiences. Yeah. Because I often find that, you know, when you're talking to authors who are trying to source permissions and they don't have that professional background that you have, it often seems like it's a really daunting task. And so I thought that it might be interesting to, at least in the beginning, like run through some hypotheticals, because oftentimes we jump to the inquiry of, you know, how do I start finding permissions? But we don't necessarily pause and think about whether we need to get permission in the first place. So the first question I thought I would ask you guys, and I don't know, and if you're shy, you don't have to shout it out, but I thought it would be fun for people to just try and shout out the answer. So the first hypothetical I came up with was, okay, so you have a character in your novel, and they work for IBM, and they drive a Mercedes-Benz, and they watch Yankee games on their TV, and their TV is a Sony flat screen. And so the question is, you know, you want to mention all these things specifically and repeatedly in your novel. Do you need to get permission from IBM and Sony?
Good question.
No. Right.
No.
Right.
No.
No. No. No, you don't, right? Because the issue here is whether you can use trademark names in your work without permission. And in general, the law gives greater leeway to free expression than it does to protecting trademark interests. Okay, so the way the case law is shaken out on this is, no, that's your right as an artist to use that in your expression.
I've noticed that the little TM is not being used as much anymore. Is that a change in the law?
That you don't, like, you don't have to put the TM?
You still have to put the TM. I haven't noticed that. I don't know why that would be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily notice that.
But you're right, though. It's not.
Yeah,
I don't
see it as much.
Yeah, I don't see it. I don't really deal a lot with trademarks, but I just know a little bit from patents that I do deal with, I mean, I teach it, deal with, you know, that you don't see it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was looking at Mr. Clune's Magic Eraser. It's not registered. I mean,
I have a question about that, because
sure.
if you use the word like Mercedes-Benz, you never see an R or TM, but let's say you use something product specific like Gore-Tex. Then you kind of see that more.
It really depends on what context you're looking at these things in. I mean, so, you know, if you're reading through a magazine, a general news story, it's very rare that you're going to see them actually using a registered trademark name, right? When you do see that, oftentimes, if you pay attention, mention, it'll be because you are looking at it in an advertisement, someone else's advertisement,
mm-hmm.
right? So then that name is being used for a commercial purpose, and that is the usefulness of having these trademark symbols in the first place. R in a circle means that that corporation is actually registered and been granted a trademark by the United States Patent and Trademark Office. TM is that you have an intention to, you know, claim,
mm-hmm.
stake out a claim for this. This is my mark.
But
I've been an editor at my time, and what we did with that last with Coca-Cola or Kleenex, or you always capitalize it in a text, and
yeah.
that
mm-hmm.
makes sense. You don't
yeah.
use the lowercase K with the Kleenex, it's always capped.
Yeah.
I do want to add, though, that it's important to keep in mind, if you're using the image, then you need to have an authorized image. You can use the word Mercedes, but if you're using an image of a Mercedes, then you have to have permission and trademark symbols on it.
Yeah, whole different thing.
So it only applies for the word, not the image.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it were an image of... Okay.
Yeah. I recently did some study about electronic books, and I wanted to use an image of a Kindle and an image of an Etch-a-Sketch. So I needed to go to Amazon, and I needed to go to Etch-a-Sketch, and I needed to ask them for permission to use the image in my poster.
What about an image of a book jacket?
I would assume that you do.
Not necessarily.
No,
and then we'll talk
well,
about that. The question is for what purpose?
Yeah.
If I'm an author
mm-hmm.
for my blog, and I want to post an image of my book cover on my blog so that all my friends
right.
know what it, and my fans, of course,
mm-hmm.
my millions of readers know what it looks like,
mm-hmm.
the answer to that is probably not.
What about
probably a fair use.
What about
a
biography?
To use an image of a book cover in a totally different book. Is that what you're asking?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, it's one of those things where it depends. It would really depend on the nature and flavor of the use and maybe a fair use. And we can talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
You're mentioning big names that everybody knows, Kleenex and IBM.
Mm-hmm.
What if you are writing fiction and it's a neighborhood and you're using the name of a store that actually exists?
Mm-hmm.
Artistic expression and trademark. So then another example that I thought might be fun for you guys, since you just had that super successful open mic poetry night, and it's something that Debbie brought up also, and I think is really important and interesting, is okay, so you attend this open mic, you know, poetry and reading night, and one of the contestants there is just so moved, and she gets up and, you know, off the top of her head, she hasn't written down notes or anything like I have here, and she just ends up, you know, reciting, let's say, five poems off the top of her head. You've been sitting there, you know, you've got a character in your book, you're no poet, and you want to come up with some good poems for this person to say. Can you, without her permission, maybe she's left, you know, maybe you're not doing anything nefarious or sneaky, maybe she's left and you couldn't pull her aside, can you use those poems in your book? Yes. Remember, no one's recording it. No one has filmed it. She hasn't written them down on paper. She's just speaking them out loud. Those are free for the taking.
Doesn't seem
moral.
Fair, though.
Yeah, well,
doesn't seem moral.
Doesn't seem fair, right?
No.
And so a lot of these permissions issues come down to, I think, in my personal opinion, it's not a legal opinion, it's just a personal opinion from working with authors. What would you want somebody to do with your work?
Well, attribute it to me,
yeah.
at least.
Right.
Be polite.
Right. Now, realistically, of course, what's going to happen is that she's going to go home and write those poems down, and
right.
then you're going to use them in your book, and you'll be in a world of trouble, because at that point, she will have fixed that intangible meaning of expression.
Can I just ask a question that's pertinent to that?
Sure.
Sometimes I'll be writing something, and I'll look at a sentence, and I'll say, boy, that's one of the best sentences I've ever written. And then in the next split second, I'll think, well, I couldn't have possibly come up with that. I must have read it 50 years ago or read it somewhere. And how in the world can you? And so sometimes I've completely taken it out.
Give yourself a break. It was all yours. That's creativity. That's creativity.
Right? But I've sometimes I've taken it out completely because I'm
But alright, I will, if that's not.
That's the balancing of there's nothing legal.
Be more creative than you're getting yourself out of.
But what if it is, let's say, a little bit of a sentence that is like verbatim from something you read 50 years ago, let's say an Iris Murdoch or something, and it's
sure.
a description of the sky, and somebody else reading it will say, oh, Iris Murdoch said the same thing, then you'll feel like a creep because but it's like, you know.
And
yeah.
here's the thing, it happens all the time, right? There have been some recently, within the last, I would say 8 years or so, some pretty famous lawsuits on Doris Kearns Goodwin,
mm-hmm.
Stephen
yes.
Ambrose.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's
right.
the balancing of there's nothing new under the sun
mm-hmm.
versus that originality requirement,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It feels original to you. There is no sort of, even under infringement analysis, just because I have produced something in my work that's taken seemingly verbatim from
mm-hmm.
your work, that doesn't mean automatically I'm in trouble. The question is, when you consider all the circumstances, does it look like I really copied from you or not, right?
Right.
Did I have access to it? Is it pretty reasonable to assume that I would have seen your work? And so that's where all that comes
if
in.
If it's
so.
Like just one sentence, though, with like two adjectives describing the sky, let's say it's blue and it's clear,
mm-hmm.
and let's say, but I mean more specifically, interesting, you know.
Yeah.
Like, Iris Murdoch, just to tell you, said the sky looked powdery. And I thought, ooh, that's so good. But I had, you know, but I had written the same thing before.
Right.
I had read that, and I
right.
thought, oh, darn it. You know, so I thought, but so that she couldn't sue me for copyright infringement if I'd taken an adjective.
Just powdery?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe not. It's a fair use analysis. We can talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, would I be open to a lawsuit? Because I didn't use it, because I thought it wasn't.
You're, I think you're fine.
Yeah. yeah. Here's the thing. What I can jump to really quickly. So just to give you an overview. The idea is, technically, any unapproved quotation, like any unauthorized, unpermitted quotation, could potentially be copyright infringement, right? But the question is, to again go back to that balancing test that Debbie was talking about. The question is, how much have I used from this other person's work? That's one word,
right?
How much of the word that I've used, the work that I've used is now being included in my work? You're using one word out of, let's say your 300,000 word novel, and so on and so forth. And so when you put all things together, if you're calling me, in my office and I'm representing you as a private attorney and you're concerned about the word powdery, first of all, I'll know you have plenty of money on your hands, right? Because you're just calling up your attorney to ask about one word. But beyond that, am I going to say, yeah, I think you're probably okay? Yeah, I probably would say, I think you're okay. Can I promise you that you're okay? No, not necessarily. And it's because of the way our laws are set up. Let me talk more about that. So, sure.
But the way you're explaining this sounds like these kinds of things get resolved in court. And if you're just an author with not many financial resources,
right.
you want to risk doing something
exactly.
where somebody with big bucks can haul you into court.
Exactly, which is why as a representative of the Authors Guild, I'm speaking as a mouthpiece for the Authors Guild here, I'm always going to recommend that you guys get prior permission. When you know, this is a little bit of a different situation, but when you know that you want to quote someone else's work, use someone else's copyright-protected work, you know it's copyright-protected, in your own work, I'm always going to advise you to seek out prior permission. And again, it boils down to what would you want somebody to do in your
mm-hmm.
work scenario.
I'm writing a memoir, and in it I refer to a very famous international concert pianist who wrote to me, I was his only friend during his childhood. He wrote very negative things about Leonard Bernstein as a conductor. And he shared many other personal feelings with me.
Mm-hmm.
I saved the letters, and I wanted to incorporate them in the passage where I refer to our friendship and I was his only friend.
Okay.
Can I quote, now these letters were written years ago,
mm-hmm.
Can I quote him in any part where he says positive things about either his personal family or his negative comments about someone like Leonard Bernstein?
Sure. Yeah. You've got a couple different things going on.
Right.
Right. So the one issue is a copyright issue. The other issue, which might be the subject for another panel, is maybe you have an invasion of privacy or
yeah.
a defamation issue, right? When it comes to the copyright permissions issue, I don't want you guys to get confused. You can quote whatever you want at any time, anywhere, right? The question, though, is, from my perspective, from a legal perspective, is that going to get you into trouble or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to get you into trouble or not? So the letters could potentially, even though they've never been published, and that's something that I did want to touch on, the letters could potentially be protected by copyright. Until 1978, so the dispositive act that we have now in the country is the Copyright Act of 1976. That's the current state of our copyright law. But in the inimitable ways of the federal government, wasn't enacted until 1978, right? So since 1978, it has been the case that anything that was unpublished up until that date was entitled to 70 years of copyright protection after the author had died. So the author's entire life plus 70 years after death. And that was the case no matter how long ago the author, if the author had died in, you know, 1776, for example, that stuff was still protected by copyright, even though it was unpublished until 2002. So the idea was to close that loophole down, enact this, you know, particular requirement in the 76 statute and take care of it that way. So it's arguable that those letters do have, they're eligible for copyright protection. So if he becomes, and he's still living, he's still with us. So if he becomes aware of your usage, and they are his letters, it is arguable that he has the right to control your use of them. Having said that, though, when it comes to jurisprudence concerning who owns the copyright in letters, that's not always, a completely uniform landscape. There are some jurisdictions that would argue that the recipient has some sort of limited copyright, well, some sort of limited permission usage to make from the letters, and then there are other jurisdictions that say absolutely not. The copyright belongs to the author.
Yes. Take a hypothetical case in which there's oral history involved. Bad malicious act on the part of one of the persons interviewed who has signed permission, the kind of permission your publisher requested, and equally signed permission from his or her opponent on this particular issue of a malicious or damaging act by person A.
Mm-hmm.
Each person is now dead. Their children survive.
Mm-hmm.
One has, in this hypothetical case, discussed the matter with and gotten the signed permission of at least one of those children, but knows that at least another of the children involved, especially the descendant of the supposedly malicious person, is a lawyer,
mm-hmm.
and does not want this information to come out.
But we're
what
talking
is the issue of defamation? And copyright that might apply here.
So it based on what you've described so far, I mean, it's a little intricate, based on what you've described, I don't hear copyright issues.
Mm-hmm.
What I hear here is invasion of privacy,
right.
defamation,
right.
potential libel issues.
Right.
Now, when it comes to the actual, you know, can you, as the surviving child, enforce a defamation claim, having to do with things that you say about the person who's passed away, the answer to that is no. Anybody who's passed away in the United States, you can say whatever you want to say about them. But that doesn't do away with your problem because there could still be false light concerns.
There could be what?
False light. False light is a sort of invasion of privacy, these sort of personal injury torts. So you place my family in a false light. You are invading our privacy. These are not things that the public really has an interest in knowing, and so on and so forth. Did you want
to? I just wanted to add on the question of oral histories. It's something that, you know, we encounter in libraries quite a bit. And the ways that libraries are approaching this is that there is an implied copyright and permission to make public an oral history, if it is recorded as an oral history, that kind of like is the purpose of an oral history. And that's how libraries have been treating oral histories.
Let me give one example, maybe it would just more vivid, which always stuck in my mind as the kind of book I didn't want to write. Kitty Kelly wrote a biography of Frank Sinatra,
mm-hmm.
which brought out the fact, apparently well documented, that his mother was an abortionist. Now, I was kind of shocked that that was published. I felt it wasn't fair to him, but it was truth. Well, where would that stand in the kinds of issues of defamation?
Yeah, again, not a copyright issue.
No, no, but defamation.
Just the defamation issue.
Yeah, suppose. Well,
so at that point, I mean, you're really looking.
One of us had written that book.
Right, so at that point, I mean, you're really looking at a balancing of what the publisher feels the risk is compared to what the claim could actually be. You can't sue someone for defamation just because they've said something that is true. So truth is a complete defense to defamation,
okay.
right? So if the argument is that, look, she was an abortionist, this is true, number one.
But it is invasion of privacy.
It's not necessarily invasion of privacy. Not necessarily. Because again, the publisher looks at the situation as a whole
mm-hmm.
and says, wait a minute, with all the information I have in front of me, as a publisher, as legal counsel, I don't feel like this is something that we need to worry about. So that's a risk assessment for that. But also defamation, not permission.
Okay.
Can you go back to the issue of letters? Because I guess my understanding
sure.
was that the letter was owned by the recipient, but that the rights were owned by the estate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
and in many cases that is true, but I can't stand here and tell you that in all cases I know that to be 100% correct. Because again, these issues are decided on a case by case basis. And so there is some case law out there that says to a certain extent, the recipient of, for example, in the case of, you know, a letter to the editor,
mm-hmm.
there is an implied
mm-hmm.
contract that's
mm-hmm.
created when you're sending a letter to the editor that you do have some limited
mm-hmm.
right of permission.
Mm-hmm.
I'm allowing you to publish this. It's reasonable
mm-hmm.
that you would put this out there in the marketplace. So there could potentially be other situations that aren't exactly letters to
mm-hmm.
the editor where it makes sense that a reasonable person wouldn't believe that I could prevent someone from ever making any part of this a public display.
And I think a little like more perhaps relevant for our day and age is really what happens with emails. You know, yeah.
The question
so
of correspondence.
Is that the case?
Yeah.
Well,
the
question of correspondence. I use 18th century, early 19th century correspondence. I get copies from Library of Congress and the National Archives and so forth, where I'm okay. But from private libraries, then if I'm going to use the quotations afterwards, I always write and ask permission.
Well, that's right.
And in fact, they always tell me that when they send me the letters, let's say 18th century Revolutionary War letters, they may not have the right to say that,
mm-hmm.
but they say you need our permission
mm-hmm.
if you're going to quote from them, and I always do.
Right, which is great, and a lot of times you'll find that people, you speak from the library perspective.
Yeah,
why does that happen even though chances are that
And I don't think it's
domain.
That great, you know, I mean, you know, there is a little bit of a culture of fear. Where people they're over cautious. They ask for permissions for things that they don't need permission for. They put copyright notices on things that are not copyrightable. So if you're looking at, you know, the Norton Anthology of 19th century English literature, there's a copyright notice. It's 19th century English poetry. Maybe the introduction is copyrighted, but that's about it. Like the other 900 pages are not. A lot of this is just like how you see the world. I would not recommend getting permission for 18th century documents, you know. But again, we come
but
from
I
different
think most,
views.
Most writers and scholars will do that. Well,
yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Two questions about letters. One, if you have letters that you're quoting from that are already published and collected,
mm-hmm.
letters of so and so. What is the copyright situation on you? I'm quoting from, say, collected letters of Faulkner
mm-hmm.
or Capote
mm-hmm.
or whatever. What
mm-hmm.
is the copyright situation?
I think that might be helpful to understand, because I don't want to get us stuck on this letters
mm-hmm.
concept, because it really has to do with dates, okay? So in the United States, anything that was first published or registered for copyright before 1923 is in the public
mm-hmm.
domain. You can quote, even if someone has collected up these letters
mm-hmm.
and put them in a book, or excuse me, even if someone has collected up this work and put it in a book and published it as of last year, you can still go to that book and copy whatever you want and quote it. You don't need permission from that publisher in the imprint book because it's free for the taking. That's what it means to be in the public domain. Anything that was first published and registered between 1923 and 1963 had to have been renewed for copyright in its 28th year. It had to have been affirmatively renewed with the Copyright Office. If it wasn't affirmatively renewed, there's no renewal record on file, that material is also in the public domain. Victor and I have had this discussion, also in the public domain. That means that you can use that material freely without needing permission from anyone. And so that's why it's good to get facility with searching the Copyright Office records if you are sometimes uncertain. You've got older material and you're uncertain as to whether you need to get permissions or not. If you've been thinking you need it, you've been trying to get it, you can't get the copyright owner to get back in touch with you, oftentimes authors will, you know, go to, for example, the catalog of copyright entries. Again, anything registered since 1978 is available online at the Copyright Office, copyright.gov. There's a searchable database. You go there, do your search, you see what you can find. There are also a couple of institutions like Rutgers and Stanford that have done some work with digitizing renewal records, right? And the reason, and putting them online, and search the internet and you'll find them. And the reason why that is because oftentimes as an author, you're searching those records to try and see if there was or wasn't a renewal.
Can I just go back to something very basic that you said about 20 minutes ago? You said that if an author can use copyrighted materials, you would always advise them to seek permission. Now, tell us what you mean by use copyrighted materials, because clearly you're not suggesting, or if you are, I'm rather surprised, but tell me if you are, but I would be surprised if you were suggesting that if you're simply quoting from a book, which is copyrighted, and you're going to footnote that quote and give proper attribution, you're certainly not suggesting that you should go back to the author of that book and ask permission to quote 15 or 20 words, or even to quote repeatedly from that book, right?
That's exactly what I'm suggesting. And here's why. Let me just finish so anything published or registered between, just to get the rest of the schematic out,
mm-hmm.
anything published or registered between 1964 and 1977,
mm-hmm.
copyright and that stuff renewed automatically. Okay? So here's why it's important. If those 23 to 77 works were renewed in the way they should have been renewed, they're protected by copyright for 95 years from the original copyright date. That means for that first batch of works, that 23 to 63, that English major, not a math major, that stuff won't start falling into the public domain until 2018. All right? Anything, the 63 to 77 batch, that stuff won't start falling into the public domain until 2015.
I use the slider.
Sure. And so here's why. So let me just revisit this issue
mm-hmm.
of attribution and why I'm suggesting that if you know something is protected by copyright, it's better to get permission than not to get permission. Okay. Attribution alone won't protect you from a copyright infringement lawsuit. Okay. If I, as the copyright owner, am objecting to your use of my work, the way our legal system is set up is that I can get into court with that claim. Now, will I win? Maybe not. Will I even find out about the use? Maybe not. Could I consult with my attorney and my attorney say there is no way in heck that you would win this lawsuit, so don't even bother? Maybe not. But some estates, especially the thing that you should know, some authors, and particularly some estates like the James Joyce estate, you guys might know about this, really litigious. The Sylvia Plath estate, they really police those copyrights.
But if you use the material, from a copyrighted book, you don't actually quote anything from that copyrighted book, and you just attribute it in a footnote as saying that, you know,
you paraphrase.
That you paraphrase it, so, but you're not actually quoting the copyrighted material, then you don't have a problem.
Maybe not.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, it's legal. It's a legal issue.
I
give you a black and white answer. What I can tell you is not black and white,
mm-hmm.
that you're going to be told this
mm-hmm.
consistently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your publisher may tell you, oh, just keep it to less than 250 words and you'll be fine.
Right.
That is wrong. It's a popular misconception. It's
mm-hmm.
wrong. Okay.
Yeah.
Paraphrasing. So,
mm-hmm.
so when we're talking about infringement, usually we're talking about verbatim copying.
Mm-hmm.
But paraphrasing, are you always safe to paraphrase?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily, because this
mm-hmm.
gets down to the expression idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
The thing that is protected is not the idea itself, it's the expression.
Right, it's the pattern.
If your paraphrasing
yeah.
is looking more and more like, you know, actually taking someone else's
mm-hmm.
expression, then you're moving into the danger zone and you need to
right.
be careful.
Okay, but if you're using them as source material, mm-hmm. not citing their words or a very close paraphrase,
mm-hmm.
then you don't have a copyright issue.
No, not at all. It's not copyright infringement. It's not copying.
I just need to add a little. I mean, we have to remember, like, one of the purposes of the copyright law is to encourage creativity.
Yeah.
It's not to protect the owners.
Right.
It is also, but it's to balance creativity with protecting the rights of the owner. So you always have to keep that in mind. And then the questions like yours, it's like, sort of like, you know, it goes back to, again, the sort of like, it depends. It depends what you're quoting. If you're quoting a work that is factual or a work of fiction. So if you're quoting, you know, a scholarly article, again, you will have probably more leeway with that than if you're quoting a work of fiction. If you are creating a work, a scholarly work, you are not doing your work if you're not quoting.
Right.
So in academia, when you are citing other people, if you're writing, you know, an article about computational linguistics and you're not citing Chomsky, you're not really doing your work. You're expected to do that, and you're not expected to go and get permission every time you're going to cite somebody in your article, because otherwise nothing would get published.
Right.
So there aren't, and do the 250 word, it's an urban myth. So it's just like, it's never about the number of words. It's about looking at the picture of the whole. You have to balance all of the factors. So it's not just you're citing or you're quoting or you're paraphrasing. It's what are you citing and for what purposes are you citing and what are you yourself going to be doing with what you're citing.
Let me give you a specific example, which is, sorry, if I could just ask the follow-up question. In a specific example of a historian writing and using an earlier historian's book as a source, let's say that that earlier historian has some fabulous encapsulation in three or four words of somebody's speech. If you were the author, you'd love it to be attributed to you, and you'd love it to be attributed to you, copyright or not. So let's say you decide to actually say, and as so-and-so said, quote, three or four words, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Would you try to get permission for that? Question to both of you.
Just
not as advice, but just as what would you do?
As my own personal experience, I probably wouldn't. But also, here's what I know. I know that the responsibility for getting permission is on me as the author. And if that other historian says the only reason why people buy my book is so that they can get the nugget of that particular sentence,
right.
That's the full economic value of it.
That's the deal for
and it. I don't go to that person and get that permission that's necessary, I know that the publisher isn't going to, in the end, suffer the ultimate harm of it, because I have in my contract a clause, a warranty and indemnification clause,
right,
that says,
I've done what I have
if
to
anybody
do.
Steps forward and sues us, we're going to look to you, buddy, to reimburse
right.
us for that. So it would be a risk assessment scenario for me.
Okay. And
Let's open up.
You mentioned that if you register your, let's say your book, within 3 months afterwards, if someone infringes upon it, you can
go after them for additional, you know, additional monies.
Alternate source of damages.
If you have a major publisher, do they automatically register for copyright for you?
Yeah, so this is good to talk about when it comes to dealing with these self-publishing outfits. The self-publishing outfits aren't going to register your copyright for you, so you're going to need to do that, and you go to copyright.gov, and everything you need is right there. But when it comes to actually traditional publication, all the large publishers, the medium-sized publishers, even the small publishers, will register copyright.
And within that 3-month period,
they'll register
when it comes out.
If I write an article using old postcards, which are in the public domain, and the postcards which I own, and I have the article published on the internet, okay, and then is there any protection if somebody else wants to take a sequence of the cards I'm using, which were originally in the public domain, which I now own, the way I arrange them, is that protected at all if somebody wants to use those images?
Arranging cards on your website?
Well, arranging them in a narrative. In other words, it's an article using a lot of images.
Mm-hmm.
Can they use a single image because it is the public domain? Or can they use five or six or seven together?
It's very unlikely that your arrangement of those postcards would rise to the level of originality that would be required for you to argue that they could be protected in some form or fashion.
We don't recognize copyright for hard work. So what is called sweat of brow. So like the fact that you labored over something and put it together, you don't get copyright over it if it's a list. So a list usually does not. So if you're writing a cookbook, for example, the list of ingredients that goes into the recipe is not copyrighted. But the kind of like the whole story of, you know, this is a recipe that has been in my family and my grandmother, that part of it is. So the hard labor is not necessarily, but your postcards, if you went to wherever they are, the archive, and they're in the public domain, and you took a picture of the postcards, and it is your picture, then your photograph is copyrighted of those. But if you use a photograph of the postcards that the National Archives created, then you don't have any rights over that.
One quick question. All of the information we're looking for today is about the United States. How would I get information about your Europe?
Yeah.
Because many of my postcards are from France and Germany, let's say.
You have the contact of, like in the UK, there's a Society of Authors.
Mm-hmm.
You could contact them and see if they could give you a reference.
But the European community doesn't have a set of copyrights like the United States.
No,
they do, but it's
country specific.
They do. And it gets a lot more complicated. I mean, some of the provisions are applied to all EU members. But there are some that are on the local level, on the state, on the individual country level. It gets a lot more complicated.
So even the 1923 cutoff date may be totally irrelevant.
I'm not even qualified to answer that.
Yeah, let's open the room. Let's hear from some people we haven't heard from.
If a scholar is quoted in an article, if I want to quote that quote, and it, of course, attribute it in a book, do I need permission from the newspaper, from the scholar?
The scholar's being quoted in an article. What's happening is that it's most likely an oral interview. And so there's no copyright protection in the statement itself. The newspaper theoretically has an argument that they've got a copyright in their particular article, but then your argument for that, again, qualitative analysis, balancing all the factors, your argument for that is, look, it is important for me to provide this particular nugget of information because it directly comments on the thing that I'm trying to critique or to criticize. So that's how that's handled.
So I don't need any information from anyone.
You may not.
So it's like Greenspan said to the New York Times, and then you're quoting, you're reiterating what Greenspan said.
Yeah.
I would say you're fine.
If it was someone like Greenspan, he's obviously, like quoting Obama,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to get sued.
Yeah.
But if it's some scholar who's not often quoted in the newspapers.
Uh-huh.
Your argument is that it is, again, four-factor analysis, right, for fair use. This is something that's necessary for criticism,
mm-hmm.
for scholarly research.
Yeah.
There's a
mm-hmm.
general public knowledge that people need to know this.
And it also, for scholars, for example, they live off attribution. They don't really get a lot of money for their publications. That, you know, they want the recognition. So if somebody is an expert in, you know, like social media and mobile devices, they're not making any money off of that beyond what Rutgers pays them, so they want your attribution.
So
they're not,
the
they don't want anything else.
That's a pattern and practice issue. So that's why, you know, this notion that you can, as long as you're using just a little bit, it's fine. That comes from a scholarly academic environment, because that is how people in that particular environment operate. We think it's good to spread this knowledge widely, to disseminate it widely.
But there's a contradiction.
She's looking at me. I haven't asked any question yet. I am going to put together a book of songs, things like "Let There Be Peace on Earth," and for a religious organization. And I have gone to the Library of Congress in Washington D.C. and I have researched songs such as "Let There Be Peace on Earth." Still covered 95 years.
Still under copyright protection?
Yeah,
oh.
So I have to contact someone in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And hope, I don't know, you know, if she's of sound mind, sound body, or whatever.
Yeah.
She's pretty old.
Yeah.
She's the widow of the original writer.
Here's the thing. Let's talk about some of the specifics. If you guys want to do that, of how
yes.
you actually go about getting these permissions, like sourcing permissions. So,
yeah.
So again, there's no centralized source, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So you check the watch. You know, website, and see if you can find contact information. There's the CCC has a lot of contact information. The Authors Registry, which is an organization somewhat affiliated with the Authors Guild, they have a, you know, large list. And so what you're trying to drill down to is, how do I actually get in touch with these people? If the book is in print, you can obviously, your life is easier because you contact the publisher. If they can give the permissions, which they often can, then they will. If they can't, they'll point you in the direction of the author or her, you know, empowered representative, like her agent. And so if it is someone like the person you've mentioned, oftentimes with a song like that, people are pretty organized about their copyright permissions. So even though she might be, and I'm not promising you this, right? But even though she might be somewhat, you know, advanced in years, and we don't know if this is something that she's used to dealing with, it could very well be that she has someone who's empowered to act on her behalf to give these permissions, because for a work like that, it wouldn't be unusual. So then what you want to do is you approach that person, and I actually, this won't be necessarily for everybody, but I don't know if you guys want to pass copies of this around. What you're going to do, the simplest thing for you to do.
Should I also pass these?
Give me a copy of each, so can explain what they are, because
yep.
they may not make sense otherwise.
Did you get
So then what you're doing is you're approaching that person and you're saying, look, you know, this is who I am. This is what I am writing. I'm writing this particular book that's going to be published by this particular publisher. If you don't have a publisher, right, it's a publisher yet to be determined. This is specifically what I want to use of yours, and this is how I want to use it. And this is where permissions becomes really tricky, because if you are working on, like, you put a lot of work, like a lot of time and effort into this already, but you don't necessarily have the permissions yet. So that's where this issue, and I would love to hear some of your experiences with this, becomes really tricky. Because if you actually need this to do all the preliminary work, and you really need to get this permission in order to, you know, bring your final product to fruition, but you don't have it and you can't get it, that's where things become really tricky. And so,
sure. Yeah, just for songs and music,
yeah.
I mean, you can also go to Ask Kath and BMI.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So with songs, you can approach ASCAP and BMI are two of the major music publishers. Another one is CESAC, S-E-S-A-C, smaller. But ASCAP, BMI, CESAC are publishing organizations. They represent the music publishers. So they'll give you the contact information for the publisher, and then you approach them with your permissions request. This is who I am. This is what I need. I want mutually from you a non-exclusive permission, right? So I don't wanna try and prevent you from, you know, giving permissions to other people and have your work be included in other places, because that's what's, you know, good about intellectual scholarship, right? People want to be able to get their hands on this widely. So I want a non-exclusive permission to include this specific part of your work in my book, let's say, just to make a life easier, in my book. My book is going to be usually what the publisher, what your publisher will want you to get is a worldwide permission, right? So I want non-exclusive worldwide rights in all formats, so that's print and audiobook and electronic territory, so you know, in the North America, in the British Commonwealth, in foreign countries, and I want to get this in perpetuity. I want to be able to use your work, continue to use it in all the revisions and editions of my particular book. And so if you agree to that, great, sign on this dotted line. That is the contract that I've given you. That's the, you know, the person agrees to give you the permission, that's what I've given you. What I want you guys to be aware of, right, is that is a really broad scope. It's a really broad grant. And so what you're always trying to drill down to, and I know you've had this experience, is you know, the publisher wants you to get as much as you can get up front so that in the future when they want to do other things with your work, they have those rights and they don't have to keep going back to get them from the copyright owner. But you, on the other hand, because remember, copyright owners can charge as much as they want for permission. They can give it to you for free if they want to. They can charge some arbitrary amount. They can charge you more than they charge you, you know, free for you and, you know, an arm and a leg for you. And that's the right that they have as the copyright owner. So what you're trying to do is bear in mind, number one, that you don't necessarily need this incredibly broad scope of rights to be granted to you, right? The other thing that you're trying to bear in mind is that you want to remember that these things are always negotiable. Hopefully, right? So there's a chance that you can negotiate. And so if you just want this for some sort of academic or educational use, but you know for whatever reason the flavor of it is that you're still probably gonna wanna seek out permission because, for example, you know, you're working on a complete retelling of something, but you need to consume a lot of the actual original work in order to be able to do what you wanna do. So you're gonna seek out permissions, but you're gonna explain, look, this is for academic scholarly uses. It's not gonna be a big commercial blockbuster. Oftentimes the states have different, they have sliding scales. I keep saying states because that's what I work with most often personally. But oftentimes copyright owners will have sliding scales. The other thing that you should bear in mind is that they'll often have fixed fee, like their own internal standards that they've come up with. So, for example, some of the estates that I personally work with, we might say, you know, generally we charge $250 per 1,000 words. And we will, you know, allow you to make this use of 1,000 words. If you want more words, we're going to, right, multiply that incrementally. So if your decision is, look, I wanted, you know, these entire 15 poems, but the nugget for my permission budget, what I actually have, I could probably get by with one of these poems. And so it's sort of a decision-making process that you might go through. Because remember, you are not, unless you are working on a book that's heavily researched or a textbook, and the publisher knows that when they make this contract with you, this money for this, you know, permission fees, that's coming out of your pocket as the author, right? And so what you want to try and pay, hopefully it's coming from But if it's not, you're going to have to, you know, bear in mind it's going to be my responsibility to pick up these costs. Because it can be the case that in the contract, and it's a drastic step, but it does happen. I've known it to happen infrequently, but it happens, that the publisher could actually, if you don't clear permissions, they have built into the contract a right to actually cancel or push back.
Take it out of your room.
Take it out. Right? And so you've spent all this time and energy and effort, you know, crafting this beautiful thing that needs somebody else's work to make it, you know, really the thing that you want it to be. And if you can't get that permission, then that's what you'll be doing.
I have a dilemma right now. My late husband and I did a book, and they credited, they gave us copyright on the photographs, but we also did some of the text.
Okay.
They credited another author's. Because all my life I've been confused with this other writer. How would you have handled that? And I'll tell you how I did.
I'm sorry, they've been credited.
They gave a credit to another writer, not to me.
Credit where? In the book itself?
On the copyright page. They credited underneath, I think it's from the Library of Congress, Thomas Jefferson and Alma Chesnut Moore.
Okay.
My name is Alma Seymour, but it's not Chesnut. So I called the printer and I said, wait a minute, we've worked on this book for 10 years, you've credited another writer.
Right.
And I thought they would put a note inside saying they had made it. Now, I'm very friendly with them, I'm doing another book, and my question is, how do I let people know this is a follow-up book?
How do
in
you
my
let
name, in my
know
name.
Well, I guess the question is, how do you let people know where?
When the book goes out and it was reviewed beautifully,
mm-hmm.
how do I let people know that Alma Chesnut Moore did not do the first book?
Yeah,
it was rather heartbreaking, I must say.
Yeah, I can imagine that is. I mean, so the way to try and handle it up front, we're still in a situation where is that book still being produced?
No,
still
the book is out of print, but it's on
yeah.
Amazon.com.
Right. So Amazon.com.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, it's a cat. I mean, to me, it's a cataloging problem.
Yeah.
Not a copyright
put
problem.
Put it on the internet.
Yeah.
And just write up something that this was a mistake.
Well,
on Amazon, you can just change it yourself.
Yeah,
you just change it yourself on Amazon. Amazon is actually coming up with the wrong author
they
information.
They still are.
Yeah, so you go on to Amazon. I just had to do this the other day. You go on to Amazon. They're going to ask you to create a user account if you don't already have one, but who doesn't already have a user account at Amazon at this point, right?
And I've gone to the Library of Congress, and they said, you have copyright now. We cashed your check.
Yeah.
We saw your book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the copyright belongs to you. So that's why I'm saying let people, you know, what venue do you need to let people know in? If it's really a matter of you just misattributed at Amazon, you go on, you say, I am the author of this book. This is what's wrong with the information that you have here. Type in the right information and
should the publisher
solved.
Have done that immediately?
It should have.
It was rather hard.
Such an impossible sentence of
Google set
me. Right. Of Google images?
And I
imported
No. I mean, there isn't a uniform copyright provision for Google images. Google doesn't create the images. It assembles them from multiple sources, and each one would have their own copyright provisions. They can be in the public domain, or they can be somebody's work.
I would stay away
from
anything that has to do with importing and
yeah.
creating and posting. Although it happens all the time, right? Because
yeah.
the internet's like the Wild West.
I did want to ask about theater. I know that back in the 70s, a large organization devoted to oral history research used the deed of gift form to circumvent issues coming down in the future for copyright and heirs and
mm-hmm.
defamation of character. I think they just asked at the end of the interview that you sign a deed of gift, and I assume that it still stands that all rights transfer.
Mm-hmm.
If you own the deed of gift,
mm-hmm.
you give that interview,
mm-hmm.
that tape to the other